DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. On today's programme,
we have representatives from over 30 countries that will be on this flotilla, and we have representatives of those campaigns. So I would like to have each one of them to come to say their name.
We meet the Gaza flotilla activists stranded in Turkey and profile Humza Yousaf, the first minister who is leaving, alongside Pedro Sanchez, the prime minister who is staying. Plus, Reporters Without Borders issues a passionate plea for the right to information. Those stories and more coming up on the programme. As international media attention focuses on the wave of anti-war protests sweeping US campuses, in Istanbul, activists from the Freedom Flotilla Coalition remain stranded after a last-minute decision by Guinea-Bissau to remove its flag from two of the three vessels. Despite this setback, many of the activists have decided to remain in Turkey in the hopes that they will still be able to deliver tons of humanitarian aid to the war-torn Gaza Strip. From Istanbul, Yelena Gostoli reports.
We are sailing soon for Palestine, but we are also sailing for much more than that. We are sailing to uphold the international legal order. I want the people of Palestine to know that you are not alone. Our governments may have abandoned you, but the people never will.
Earlier this month, international and Turkish activists made headlines with a bold announcement. A three-boat flotilla bound for Gaza was ready to set sail from Turkey. An aging cruise ship, the Akdeniz, or Mediterranean in Turkish, was moored at an Istanbul port and ready to set sail alongside two other vessels, loaded with around 500 passengers and an impressive 5,000 tons of aid. Activists from diverse backgrounds converged on Istanbul after answering the call of the Freedom Flotilla Coalition, which is coordinated by the Turkish Humanitarian Relief Foundation. Among them were Spanish politicians, Jordanian housewives, and even US veterans. Their aim? To challenge Israel's blockade of the Gaza Strip and deliver much-needed aid.
We have representatives from over 30 countries that will be on this flotilla. And we have representatives of those campaigns. So I would like to have each one of them to come to say their name.
My name is Carlos Trota. I am a physician from Argentina.
My name is John Herson. I'm a truck driver from Ireland.
My name is Martina Velarde. I am a member of the Spanish Parliament.
My name is Nima Mashouf. I'm epidemiologist from the Mission from Canada.
My name is Suzanne Adeli, and I am the president of the National Lawyers Guild in the USA.
But 2 weeks later, the flotilla remained stranded. After several departure delays, the West African country of Guinea-Bissau requested an inspection and then withdrew its flag from two of the ships.
In its communication informing us of this cancellation, the Guinea-Bissau International Ships Registry made specific reference to our planned mission to Gaza.
With both UN agencies and the International Court of Justice warning that the already catastrophic humanitarian situation is at risk of deteriorating further, activists say they are determined to reach Gaza. This is despite the tragic precedent set by a similar mission 14 years ago when 10 activists lost their lives in an Israeli maritime raid on the Mavi Marmara, sparking a diplomatic crisis between Israel and Turkey that lasted for years.
We hope to get there, and if it's they attack us and it doesn't get in, well, once again, we can show the world Israel's a rogue state and they don't care about humanity.
John Herson is a 54-year-old truck driver from Ireland who has previously driven 8 convoys through Gaza's border with Egypt.
I mean, to sit and look at the minute, to see hundreds of 8 trucks sitting queued up, not allowed in, it's the year 2024, and how on earth is the world allowing it to happen? The fear that we are going to experience is nothing compared to the fear that the Palestinians in Gaza have been enduring for the past 6 months.
Following the Hamas-led attack on southern Israel on October 7th, in which some 1,200 people were killed and 250 hostages taken, Israel tightened its existing blockade of the Gaza Strip. According to Israel, the blockade is necessary to prevent weapons from reaching Hamas and other fighters in Gaza. The seven-month war has so far killed more than 34,000 Palestinians, mostly women and children, according to the Hamas-run health ministry, whose numbers are generally seen as reliable by UN agencies. Most of the Gaza Strip's population has been displaced, and the UN says Gaza is on the brink of famine, with the majority of its population facing severe food shortages and economic hardship. Earlier this year, the International Court of Justice issued a stark warning, finding that at least some of the acts alleged in a case brought by South Africa against Israel could fall under the provisions of the Genocide Convention. Over the past 2 weeks, activists and supporters have taken to the streets in Istanbul in hopes of pressuring the Turkish government to greenlight their departure. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has voiced staunch support for the Palestinian cause, but critics point out that the Turkish government's actions tell a different story. For 6 months after the start of the war, Ankara maintained trade relations with Israel. It was only recently that the government announced a decision to ban the export of selected Turkish products until a ceasefire is agreed.
It makes my heart break to see the Israeli state say that they represent me. They do not.
Among those hoping to sail to Gaza is Wynne Kaufman, a retired Jewish-American engineering teacher from Detroit.
20 years ago, after Ariel Sharon went into Gaza and the West Bank and massacred people there, I couldn't look away anymore. And so I educated myself and I went to Palestine and I saw with my own eyes how horrible the occupation is and how cruel and inhumane.
Among the organizations participating in the flotilla are the Mavi Marmara Association, the left-wing anti-war feminist movement Code Pink, and the NGO Malaysia My Care. Spanish MP Martina Velarde of the left-wing party Podemos has joined a delegation of Spanish politicians who flew to Istanbul to board the ship. The Spanish government stands out as a vocal critic of Israel among EU states, but Velarde highlights the frustration felt by many who believe that more decisive action is needed from governments worldwide.
We have to demonstrate that all the voices that are taking to the streets in solidarity with the Palestinian people worldwide are also represented here in this initiative, when the international community and governments are looking the other way. We think the Spanish government isn't doing enough. You can't just talk about peace and then increase military spending.
Coming from there, we might choose to sit, but noticing what's happening, so it's not coming from behind us.
Ahead of departure, activists are undergoing what they call nonviolence training. In a series of workshops, they are learning techniques to de-escalate and minimize the risk of harm to themselves and others in the event of a confrontation with the Israeli army and potential arrest. Zaher Birawi, a Palestinian who lives in the UK and chairs the International Committee to Break the Siege on Gaza, calls on the Turkish government to let the flotilla leave.
We understand the complications of the politics in the region, but Turkey, I think, as a government, is one of the governments who shows support for Palestine, and this is why we expect, if not facilitating, at least not to making any difficulties for this mission.
As the war in Gaza rages on and solidarity with Palestinians grows on university campuses in Western capitals, the flotilla to Gaza finds itself at a standstill. Eleni Agostoli, DW Istanbul.
A week, they say, is a long time in politics. For two of Europe's leaders, the past week quite possibly felt like a lifetime as they weighed their political futures in the balance. One of the men in question, Spain's socialist Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, has decided to stay. The other, Scotland's Scottish Nationalist First Minister, Humza Yousaf, has announced his resignation. Here's Nick Martin to tell us why.
Hamza Youssef was barely a year into the job as Scotland's first minister or head of government when he announced last Monday that he was quitting. The country's youngest and first Muslim leader was brought down by his decision to oust the Green Party from his governing coalition and fire two Green Party ministers due to differences over climate change goals. Youssef decided to scrap Scotland's target of reducing carbon emissions by 75% by 2030, which the Green Party initially backed, but then said it would have to put to its members. The First Minister was then unable to persuade other parties to back his minority government, and with no prospect of victory in two confidence votes, he quit rather than be forced out.
Unfortunately, in ending the Bute House Agreement in the manner that I did, I clearly underestimated the level of hurt and upset that caused Green colleagues. For a minority government to be able to govern effectively and efficiently, trust when working with the opposition is clearly fundamental. And while a route through this week's motion of no confidence was absolutely possible, I am not willing to trade my values and principles or do deals with whomever simply for retaining power.
The son of first-generation immigrants from Pakistan, Youssef grew up in Glasgow before being elected to the Scottish Parliament in 2011. Last October, his family were caught up in the latest Middle East tensions. His parents-in-law were trapped in war-torn Gaza for nearly a month as Israel began its retaliation on the Palestinian militant group Hamas for the October 7th attack. Support for Youssef's Scottish National Party, or SNP, had already been weakened by a campaign finance scandal that saw the party's chief executive and husband of predecessor Nicola Sturgeon charged with embezzlement. A new hate crime law also caused division within the party, along with legislation that made it easier for people to change their gender, which was vetoed by the UK government in London. The SNP has been the dominant party in Scottish politics for almost two decades, and in 2014 held a referendum to try to take Scotland out of the UK, which was rejected by 55% of voters. Favourites to replace Youssef are former Deputy First Minister John Swinney and Kate Forbes, a Conservative Christian lawmaker who narrowly lost to Youssef in the last leadership contest. Both have yet to confirm they will run for the job. The SNP is currently two votes short of an overall majority in the 129-seat Scottish Parliament. The party may also struggle to restore public confidence ahead of elections for the UK-wide Parliament, which are widely expected to unseat Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's Conservatives later this year. The SNP currently holds 43 of Scotland's 59 seats in the UK National Parliament. The main opposition Labour Party, which used to dominate Scottish politics, is hoping for a resurgence in support from Scottish voters to help it win an outright majority.
Nick Martin with that explainer there on the Scottish First Minister, Hamza Youssef, the man who decided to leave. Next, it's the turn of our Madrid correspondent Ashish Sharma, who has been profiling Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, the man who decided to stay.
Pedro Sanchez disappeared from the political scene for 5 days after his heart-on-his-sleeve letter on X last Wednesday. A right-wing group, which calls itself Clean Hands, accused his wife, Begoña Gómez, of political corruption and opened a case against her. It was the last straw for Sanchez, who said this was nothing more than right-wing dirty tactics, but this time aimed at his wife. A push too far. He would reflect for 5 days and make a decision on Monday. It was 5 days in which the right thought they'd found a crack and went for the jugular. His fan base, though, came out in strong defence. A demonstration up to Parliament on Sunday called for the love of democracy saw thousands turn out and beg Sanchez to continue. And then the moment. Monday morning, a strident Sanchez strode up to the podium outside the Prime Minister's residence, and he delivered a savage blow. A blow to the hopes of the far-right Vox and the conservative Partido Popular.
He decidido seguir. Seguir con más fuerza si cabe al frente de la presidencia del gobierno de España.
I've decided to continue and to come back even harder, he vowed. In subsequent interviews, Sanchez said the first person who asked him to continue was his wife, Begoña Gómez. Clean Hands, the group that seemed to have pushed him too far, even admitted after his letter on X that perhaps they'd been fed some bad information regarding the corruption allegations and had withdrawn their complaint in the Spanish courts. And now it seems that Sanchez is willing to use his own tough tactics against his political opponents. He's talked about sidestepping the Partido Popular, which has for over 4 years now blocked the renewal of the judiciary. And he's vowed to examine what action can be taken against media which peddle in false information and false truths. If indeed pushing Pedro Sanchez to the edge was a tactic of the right to break the Prime Minister, it could well be one to come back and haunt them. Ashish Sharma, DW, Madrid.
The politicking continues in just a minute. We've an interview with the director of Reporters Without Borders Brussels office coming up. That's here with me, Kate Laycock, on Inside Europe. May 3rd is World Press Freedom Day, the date on which the NGO Reporters Without Borders traditionally releases its World Press Freedom Index. Ahead of that event, I spoke to Junie Majazak, Director of Reporters Without Borders Brussels office. With EU elections just around the corner, I asked Junie to begin by giving me her assessment from a press freedom perspective of the outgoing legislature.
I have to admit that the EU has done a lot to protect media freedom during the past 5 years, with the Digital Services Act, the DSA, which regulates the platforms, the anti-slap directive against abusive lawsuits, and above all, the first legislation on media freedom at the EU level with the European Media Freedom Act. I can also mention a code of practice against disinformation, the recommendation on safety of journalists, and also the annual report on the rule of law in the EU, which includes a chapter on media. However, we believe that unprecedented challenges still lie ahead, particularly in the face of disinformation and technological capabilities for manipulating content like generative AI, ChatGPT. So we really believe that there is still much to be done to safeguard our right to information and to restore trust in the media.
Well, indeed. And Reporters Without Borders has got a call out for a new deal for the right to information. Could you perhaps explain to me in a bit more detail what is meant by the right to information?
So, yes, we have drafted this 12-point manifesto, and it's the result also of the fact that over the last few years we've been rethinking our work to take into account the digital environment and the growing role of social networks and their impact on news and information, because it's a real revolution, like the printing press or television were in their day. And this has led us to slightly change our perspective from press freedom to the right to information and reliable information.
I was just thinking that, you know, people listening might be thinking, but hang on, you know, I've got more information at my fingertips than any generation before. You know, I can just look at my phone and I've got access to, you know, whatever sites I want. I'm the king of information, me, in this new world. What exactly are the dangers to our right to information that you're identifying?
No, you're right. It's not, I mean, we're not saying that platforms and social networks and artificial intelligence is all bad. Not at all, but it needs to be regulated. Because today, half of humanity spends 2.5 hours a day on social network. And they mostly consume artificial intelligence recommended content. And they are, social networks are also the place where people get their news. And what does it mean when I say recommended content? It means that the dissemination of information is left in the hand of a few platforms and social networks. This dissemination of information is based on algorithmic recommender system whose only aim is to capture our attention in order to generate advertisement and therefore money. So they grab our attention, and to grab our attention, they show what is sensational, what is polarized, divisive, etc. And reliable media content is pushed to the margin.
How worried are you about this phenomenon in the context of the upcoming European elections?
Well, we are worried, but it's not only for the European election. Disinformation discredits the entire information space. You know, fake news discredit all information, including reliable journalistic information. They blur the line, they confuse the issues, and then they are no longer fact or truth. It's only, you know, opinions, emotions, alternative truth. And if I can quote Anna Arendt, she said, "When everybody lies, the consequence is not that you believe the lies, but that nobody believes anything any longer. And when you no longer believe anything, you cannot make up your mind, you cannot think, you cannot judge anymore."
What could the EU as a body do to protect our right to information?
To reverse the logic and to oblige platforms to promote reliable sources of information and give them more visibility in their algorithmic system instead of promoting divisive and polarized content over journalistic content. So that's really our main recommendation. So that's why we are advocating for a legal obligation, because if you leave it to the platforms, they're not going to change their business model.
The right to information, I mean, we're familiar with the right to freedom from torture, the right to a family life, the right to food, etc., etc. The right to information, it's up there with all of those, is it?
So I think it's really at the centre of the democracy, the right to information. All the other rights come from the right to information. Otherwise, you won't have any idea of if your rights are respected or which right do you have. You know, if you're not informed, you won't be able to have any thinking and any judgment.
Junie Majazak is director of the Brussels office of the NGO Reporters Without Borders. May 3rd is International Press Freedom Day. If you open up this week's edition of the programme in Spotify, you'll see that we're using our poll of the week to do a little research of our own into the state of press freedom where you live. We do hope that you'll take part. Inside Europe is, of course, available on all the other usual podcast platforms, including YouTube via the DW Podcasts channel. With just a month to go until European elections, do make sure that you're subscribed wherever you do get your podcasts. And, of course, we are always massively appreciative of your likes and ratings, because they're the things that really do help other people to find us. We also really enjoy hearing from you via the feedback address, which is insideeurope@dw.com. That's the place to get in touch with us, tell us what you think of the show, and share with us your ideas for upcoming editions of the programme. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany.
This is Inside Europe with me, Kate Laycock, in Germany. Coming up in the next half hour, on your Maastricht, get set, go. EU election season has officially opened. Born European, why is the far right succeeding with the children of EU enlargement 20 years on? Knives out for RTVS. Is this the end for Slovakia's public broadcaster? Plus, a cultural double whammy as we take a trip to Venice under its new pay-to-get-in rules. And also, we'll be finding out how Denmark is managing to cash in on Sweden's Eurovision limelight. That's all still to come.
From the studios of Germany's international broadcaster, DW, this is Inside Europe.
Let's give our candidates a warm welcome.
Campaigning for the European elections taking place in June has kicked off in earnest now, with the first debate among political leaders taking place this week in the Dutch town of Maastricht. Terry Schultz was there to check in with the young people in the audience to see how they thought the candidates did, with just a few weeks to go before ballots are cast.
The next European Parliament will be chosen June 6th through the 9th in elections taking place in every European Union member state. These newly installed lawmakers will then choose the next head of the European Commission, the job currently held by Ursula von der Leyen, who wants to keep it. She made her case Monday night to almost 1,000 university students in the audience in Maastricht.
You were a huge motivation for me during these 5 years with many, many crises, to stay the course. And from that experience, going forward, I want a strong Europe instead of weakness. I want unity instead of polarization. I want a Europe that cares, that protects, that prospers. And above all, this election is about democracy. And democracy is about choices. So my message tonight is, do not let others make the choice for you.
While von der Leyen is expected to be renominated to head the Commission because her group, the European People's Party, is forecast to remain the largest in a new parliament, other political leaders are determined to make her work for it. In fact, after the debate on Monday, it was the Green leader, Bas Eekhout, who participants chose as the person they would most like to see as EU Commission president after elections.
If you vote Green, we will make very clear what we are going to fight on. We are going to deliver on climate policies. We are going to reduce your cost of living. We are going to invest in our green economy. We will make sure you keep your freedom. And very important, we will not bow to the pressure of populists and Putin friends.
His popularity on Monday may have had something to do with being Dutch, however. In fact, polls show the Greens are going to be among the parties losing support in these elections. Also on stage that night, a member of the younger generation, Maëlys Rosberg, the 24-year-old lead candidate of the European Free Alliance, which describes itself as an umbrella organization of 41 nationalist, regionalist, and autonomous parties throughout the EU, representing stateless nations, emerging new states, regions, and traditional minorities in Europe.
I was born in the year 2000, and for most of my life, I took Europe for granted. I truly believed in the promise of prosperity, stability, and peace. I believed in Europe. But we all know that times have changed. The promise we were given has failed. I'm standing here today because I realized that nothing can be taken for granted, and that now, more than ever, it's time to raise our voices for democracy, for minorities, and for the climate. I'm here to argue that real change is possible.
But speaking to members of the audience after the debate, we didn't find a lot of enthusiasm about what they'd heard.
I guess I felt that a lot of the debate was more about what others were not doing, attacking one another, rather than focusing on what each candidate wanted to do for, you know, continuing this European dream.
So I'm a member of the Green Party myself. However, I thought that our Green candidate, well, he was a bit disappointing tonight. I think he could have squeezed Ursula von der Leyen a little bit more on what she promised and didn't deliver.
Another disappointment for the crowd was the abrupt cancellation of hours of festive events scheduled for after the debate. Dutch police took this measure after a small pro-Palestinian protest was held on the same square. You can hear a police dog barking at the demonstrators as we stood there. This heavy-handed response to what many considered free speech, at a debate on the future of democracy, didn't sit well with many young people, some of who had come from other cities for the event.
If we really want to think about European democracy and the land of freedom and values, this is not the way to treat people. They just want to be heard, and it's a bunch of students.
At the moment, youth participation is expected to go up in these elections, as it did the last time the EU Parliament was elected in 2019. But whereas that time climate-friendly candidates benefited, this time polls show it could be the far right that wins their votes. Terry Schultz, DW, Maastricht.
As we just heard there, there is increasing disillusionment amongst young Europeans when it comes to politics, and that is something that the far right is banking on capitalising on in the June elections. Now, the EU's newer member countries, celebrating 20 years of membership this week, are no exception here, as was made clear in a recent article published in the Journal of Democracy. Its title is East Central Europe, the Young and the Far Right, and its author is Laura Jarkley, Assistant Professor in the Business, Government and International Economy Unit at Harvard Business School. When we spoke earlier, Laura began by reflecting on the significance of 20 years of EU enlargement.
Yeah, it's actually an exciting time to reflect on what it means for an entire generation to grow up under EU quote-unquote rule and integrated into the EU, and sort of what values does that generation take for granted, what sort of ideological commitments they have, and what might they not have that we might expect them to have conditional on having grown up as a member of the EU.
And you say that East Central Europe's young adults are at a bit of a ideological crossroads at the moment. If I take that literally and sort of imagine myself at a crossroads, what would the signposts be that I would be looking at?
It would literally be, do you imagine yourself as sort of a leftist, progressive, liberal, or do you hold much more traditional values that are a little bit more in line with ethnic homogeneity and values that are not necessarily stereotypically what you think of when you think of Western liberalism or the value scheme you accept as a member of the EU when it comes to multiculturalism and commitments to minority rights?
Well, far-right parties in these countries are very much hoping that the answer is going to be pointing towards their direction. They are targeting young adults in their party programs very, very heavily. Are they right to believe that they have a meaningful share of latent supporters amongst this young demographic?
The answer is yes and no in different ways. What gives the far-right hope is really the fact that on some values, the 18 to 30-year-old voter segment is actually moving further to the right. So if you look at European social surveys, focus groups, interviews being done with this generation over multiple election cycles at this point, they are increasingly anti-immigration. They are more skeptical of EU integration than the generation before them, and fewer report that minority rights are important to democracy. Some are also open to what we would call strong leader alternatives to their ailing democracies. In other words, they're increasingly holding a mixture of views that is ideologically inconsistent with either leftist party platforms or traditional right-wing platforms. And so if we think of ideological fit in static terms, then the answer is still no. People between 18 and 30 years old still remain the most progressive when it comes to women's rights, LGBT rights, and even the issue of immigration, just as a static measure. But at the same time, like I said, compared to prior generations, they're becoming more skeptical of other multicultural values.
Can I just pick up on that? Because it's so interesting, because one of the things that really caught my eye in this article is the way in which you talk about generational experiences. So things that people undergo in adolescence and early adulthood at sort of formative times in their lives, and the way in which these experiences play a role in shaping their political outlooks. And you picked out the Syrian refugee crisis in 2015 as being a crucial sort of turning point, a shaping moment for this generation.
Yes. So simply put, the more hardline nationalist narratives promoted by leaders like Hungary's Viktor Orban, Slovakia's Robert Fico and Poland's Andrzej Duda, at the height of the refugee crisis, have shifted the attitudes of the region's youth rightward. Over the same period, survey evidence shows that young adults fall behind other cohorts in their zest for democracy. Now, this is more to do with the pitfalls of democracy in practice than in theory. East Central Europe's youth have significantly downgraded their perceptions of national electoral integrity. They're less likely to believe that elections are free and fair, less likely to believe that voting is an effective way to punish bad performance by governing parties. And this is because they also came of age during a period of single party and single leader hegemony, in which power seldom changed hands, if at all, in their region.
So we're sort of talking about young people who, in theory, would say, yeah, I like the idea of living in a democracy, but in practice, their experience of living in a democracy has been disappointing, has moved them towards either cynicism or apathy because they've become disillusioned with the process. And this then makes them open or at least vulnerable to approaches from the far right. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's perfect. And just to add to that, one more point on the pivotal experience in adolescence and early adulthood of the 2015 Syrian refugee crisis. Although it is often claimed or implied that younger Europeans accept multiculturalism, whereas their elders in Eastern Europe are the ones that remain skeptical of it, all of the evidence from surveys and qualitative focus groups really raised doubts over this. And the explanation really lies, in my opinion, on how the crisis was quote-unquote received in East Central Europe as distinguished from Western Europe. Nothing like the warm refugees welcome messaging of Sweden at the time, or Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel declaring quote-unquote, we can do this, was heard across Eastern Central Europe. And so the difference in leaders' attitudes across the two parts of Europe have had significant effects nearly 10 years removed on the political socialization of young people.
What's the main takeaway that you would want people, and I'm thinking particularly policymakers in Brussels, to take away from your article?
Yeah, so the far right really isn't the only force which stands to gain from this general dissatisfaction. Outsiders in general, outsider parties, have a better shot at mobilizing the segment of the electorate. It just happens to be that some of the most successful outsiders at the moment are far right ideologically. But what's happening at its core is a turn away from what young adults perceive as stale politics. Once mainstream parties realize that their traditional bases are shrinking and that they must pivot in order to appeal more strongly to young voters, these parties will swiftly come to realize that they have no first mover advantage left, because the far right's really beaten them to the target. They're talking so much more about demographic decline and how to bring young people back to Eastern Europe, what kind of economic incentives they can provide to do that, how they can set up families and help them do that in an economically sound way. It's just sort of high time for other parties to make this more explicit as a discussion point as well.
I was speaking to Harvard Business School's Laura Jackley there, author of the essay East Central Europe, The Young and the Far Right, which is published in the April edition of the Journal of Democracy. Slovakia was amongst the cohort of 2004's new member states, and critics fear that under Robert Fico's populist nationalist coalition, it is currently moving towards the status of an illiberal democracy along the lines of Viktor Orban's Hungary. One of the most alarming signals so far came last week when the government approved a bill which would abolish Slovakia's national broadcaster and replace it with a similar body under new management. From Prague, in the neighbouring Czech Republic, or Czechia, Rob Cameron reports.
The main evening news on public broadcaster RTVS, or Radio and Television of Slovakia, an institution that's likely entering its final months in its current form. Prime Minister Robert Fico and his coalition allies want to replace it, and fast. If the bill gets through Parliament, Radio and Television of Slovakia would disappear in June to be replaced by a new broadcaster, Slovak Television and Radio, headed by a new Director General. The bill was submitted by Culture Minister Martina Šimkovičová, a nominee of the ultra-nationalist Slovak National Party. Here she is, announcing the news following the recent cabinet meeting which approved the legislation.
Je to zákon, ktorým vzniká nová verejnoprávna.
It's a law which will bring about the creation of a new public service broadcasting institution. One of the main attributes will be that we're returning the adjective Slovak to the name, which is an unequivocal declaration of the national and nation-forming character of the public broadcaster. It should be quite clear to everyone that RTVS cannot continue functioning in the way it has up to now. Slovak society is truly divided, and to heal these divisions, we will continue to fulfill the points in the government manifesto.
Ms. Šimkovičová went on to accuse RTVS of political activism, accusing the broadcaster of a lack of objectivity and only giving airtime to mainstream views. Prime Minister Fico also echoed those words and said any broadcaster that was in permanent conflict with the government could not be objective, and Slovaks were being denied access to impartial information, all charges the station denies. In the end, his government has backtracked slightly from an original plan to bring the broadcaster under much tighter state control, abandoning an original law that would allow it to sack the director general at will. A proposed editorial committee that would be allowed to meddle in the station's output has also been dropped. But critics, including 1,200 RTVS employees who've signed a petition against the bill, are fearful for the fate of public media under Mr. Fico's government. Sonja Vajsová is head of foreign news for the broadcaster's radio department.
The company, the RTVS and the special radio where I work, they don't belong to the politicians, they belong to people, the listeners, and to us as a journalists, not to the politicians. And I think that's why a lot of people in the company, 1,200 employees and freelancers, joined this kind of open letter against the proposed law, because we love our work. We make it because we love it, and we want to make it for our listeners. We don't make it because of the money. We make it as a public service, and this is some kind of higher principle.
Indeed, many wonder at the fitness of the Slovak National Party to decide the fate of Slovakia's cultural and media institutions. Before becoming minister, Ms. Šimkovičová presented an online TV channel that spread COVID disinformation and pro-Russian narratives on the war in Ukraine. And her close colleague, Lukáš Machala, the senior ministry official spearheading the effort to replace RTVS, gave a breathtaking interview to the station this week in which he was asked what kind of non-mainstream views it should be presenting. The Earth's round, asked the reporter, but some people believe it's flat. Should we get them on? How do you know it's round? Mr. Machala replied. After all, you haven't been to space, and neither have I. For DW, this is Rob Cameron in Prague.
What was that Hannah Arendt idea? The purpose of lies isn't to make you believe the lie, it's to make you doubt the possibility of truth. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. We're off to Venice next. A visit to the Italian city of Venice is, according to Truman Capote, like eating an entire box of chocolate liqueurs all in one go. Well, those chocolates now come with a price tag. In an attempt to temper the enormous influx of tourists to the city, a €5 entrance charge has been introduced. Angelo van Schaik dug deep into his pockets and took the hit for us.
It is very busy on the square behind the train station in Venice. Thousands of tourists are making their way past porters and tour guides and are on their way to the Rialto Bridge and Piazza San Marco. Dressed in fluorescent yellow or orange vests, a dozen stewards are awaiting the mass of tourists to check the QR code. To visit Venice, you have to pay now. You have to go to a special website, enter your personal details, pay €5 per person, and then you obtain a QR code. Unless you are one of the many exceptions. Children under the age of 14, people who work in a city, are a resident in the Veneto region, or have booked a hotel room, are exempt from payment. Like Giovanni and his family from Florence.
We don't have to pay today. We booked a hotel room. I don't know whether this is a good idea. Cities like Venice, Rome, or now my city Florence, are assaulted by tourists. There's so much to see. People will come anyway.
The entrance ticket is meant to temper the enormous amount of tourists that visit Venice every year. Venice is one of the most popular tourist attractions in the world and has been struggling with seasonal overcrowding for years. Especially day trippers are a big problem. They often cost the city of Venice more than they deliver. They tend to spend little money. Many of them buy as little as a cup of coffee, but use water and public toilets, take up space on the pavements, and also their rubbish has to be collected. In peak year 2019, 23 million tourists, mainly day trippers, squeezed themselves through the narrow city streets. In 2023, a bit less, but still too many. UNESCO threatened to blacklist Venice because of the damage caused by the mass tourism. According to Sebastiano Giorgi, born and raised in Venice, the measure is hypocritical.
On one hand, the city continues to issue permits for hotels and restaurants. On the other, to ease their conscience and to placate UNESCO, they invented this entrance fee.
According to Giorgi, a tourist won't be stopped by €5 more or less. In the last 40 years, he saw his Venice change from a city with a diverse economy to a city with a monoculture, in which everything had to give way for tourism.
Through this measure, Venice has become like a theme park, and residents are just extras in a tourist's dream. On top of that, if a friend of mine wants to visit me, he has to pay an entrance fee. If I want to invite someone to my house, I have to go to a website, enter their personal details, and give them a QR code so they don't have to pay the fee. That's a violation of privacy and putting limits on our freedom of movement. I am no longer a normal citizen.
Notwithstanding the entrance fee, it is busy in Venice. Very busy. In front of the San Marco Basilica, there's an endless queue. While a little orchestra in front of the historical Café Florian plays Don't Cry for Me Argentina, and souvenir sellers make a lot of money with odds and ends made in China. But Charlie and Josephine from London think the entrance fee is a good idea.
As long as it's to save Venice, seems a good idea.
I think ultimately, I don't know how much it is.
€5.
I think it's a good thing. Because it is sinking and it's... Yeah, I think the world we live in now, we have to save things. And I think, you know, €5, if you can afford to get here, then you can pay €5.
Venice is trying to do something about over-tourism, but it seems a bit of a clunky effort. No one really believes the €5 fee will stop tourists from visiting the beautiful Italian city. What's lacking is long-term vision on how to deal with over-tourism, not only in Venice, but also in other popular tourist destinations in Europe. Angelo van Schaik, DW, Venice.
A mixed week for Venice then, but at least Copenhagen is flying high, albeit for a rather cheeky reason. Denmark's capital is cashing in on Eurovision, and that's despite the fact that Sweden are this year's hosts of the European Song Contest. The Swedish host city of Malmö is, however, connected to Copenhagen by a bridge. And yes, it is that bridge, the one that's featured in the Scandi Detective series of the same name. And it's only a hop, skip and a jump away for Eurovision fans who've decided they'd rather stay in Denmark and commute. Daniel Rosny reports.
Next station will be Copenhagen Central Station, and this train will continue to Österport.
Less than 30 kilometres away from the main action in Malmö, where official events in the Eurovision host city are taking place, many bars and clubs in Copenhagen, a short train ride away, are predicting business will be booming over the next 10 days or so, as many visitors are staying in the Danish capital and making day trips to Sweden.
So we've been staying in a hostel in Copenhagen, visiting around different places in Copenhagen, and obviously we've met people in the hostel and made other plans.
Copenhagen's obviously a lot bigger, Malmö, but then again, Copenhagen's capital of Denmark, isn't it? Malmö's not capital of Sweden. They're very similar in such, but I'd say Copenhagen's like a bit more, so far, a bit more fancy, a bit like, you know, it's what you expect from a capital city, a bit bigger, yeah, a bit more touristy, but no, Malmö's nice as well.
Even those staying in Malmö are expected to travel here to the Danish capital, where they'll see builders have started work on the city's famous stock exchange, which was recently damaged in a huge fire. The train operator has even put on a special fare from the 5th to the 12th of May for unlimited trips costing around 30 euros. Journeys take a little more than half an hour between the two cities and run roughly every 15 minutes with hourly services through the night. Even the Eurovision acts are enjoying visiting two cities.
It's a lot more expensive than Sweden. I thought it was going to be cheaper than Sweden, but boy, was I wrong. I paid like a lot. I never paid that much for a lunch. I'm Baby Lasagna, and I'm representing Croatia with the song Rim Tim Tagidim. Other than that, I think it's beautiful. It's something that we can't see in Croatia or any other neighboring countries. The architecture, the colors, the canals or whatever. I don't know what that is even. Absolutely, like, out of this world.
Croatia has never won Eurovision. Could this be the year?
Yeah, it's exciting. When I saw people dancing throughout Croatia and every major city, it totally changed the perspective of what I'm doing here. So before I saw all of that, I was like, well, I'm going to Eurovision and a few people are cheering me on and that's cool.
Because there have been flash mobs across Croatia.
When I saw those videos, it was like, okay, this is not about me. This is about Croatian and Croatia people, and they're happy and I'm happy that they're happy. But now we have to really give it a go, you know what I mean?
When Eurovision was last in Malmö in 2013, around 30% of visitors chose to stay in Denmark. Copenhagen has about five times more hotel rooms than Malmö, and Danish tourism officials say the average visitor stayed for 4.5 days, spending 280 euros a day on average. That's a big boost for the local economy if a third of the 100,000 Eurovision fans again choose to stay in Denmark rather than Sweden. Copenhagen police say there'll be an increased police presence here next week as the party splits across the two cities. After parties, club nights and gigs are being organised all around the Danish capital for next week, so you're likely to see many in fancy dress if you're in Copenhagen.
My name is Brian and I'm here at Nevermind in Copenhagen.
And what's your role here?
I'm the owner.
You're so close to the train station.
Yes.
There's expected to be between 30 and 50,000 Eurovision fans coming to Copenhagen from Malmö. Surely that's going to be good for business.
It's a big party everywhere, yeah. So we open a bit earlier. I love Eurovision, yeah. Best day ever.
Eurovision's motto is United by Music. This year, the party is divided, figuratively and also quite literally, by the Øresund Bridge, with Denmark likely to make a huge profit on the back of a Swedish event. Daniel Rosny, DW News, Copenhagen.
Next week is Eurovision finals week, so we will be having more from Daniel Rosny on the show then. For now, though, we've reached the end of the programme, which was produced by me, Kate Laycock, with help from Nick Martin and sound engineer Jürgen Kuhn. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.